Okay, so in years past, we've given a shiur for called Profiles of Persecution. I think last year we broke the mold in that, maybe it was a couple of times. We've spoken about people who may have had a difficult episode of their lives due to persecution, but not necessarily die al Kiddush Hashem. So tonight is, I believe, another example. It's a little unclear. I wasn't able, there is actually no, from what I understand, no definitive biography on the Shach. Rav Shabtai Cohen, but which is interesting because he is a real seminal figure in terms of the history of halacha. In some ways, he could be credited with really establishing the Shulchan Aruch as the central book of halachic psak. And he did have an interesting life, as we're going to see. Not a very long life, but an interesting life. But there's not that much officially out on him in biographical form. But I was able to collect a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and we could present a little bit about the lifetime of the Shach. The Shach of Shabtai Cohen was born in 1622 in a town called Ambustavi in Lithuania. Now, we think about Lithuania as being like a central location of Jewish Europe, but then it wasn't. In fact, the Shach may be considered, if not the first or the second, one of the very early Rabbanim of Vilna. When he became the Rav of Vilna, as we'll see, and he was like it was a real outlier town at that time. It was almost built after the Shach was there. But he was born in an even smaller town. There is one of the things that I listened to or read or put together was Rabbi Ezra Schwartz gave a talk about the Shach and the Taz in terms of their place in halacha. And the way he described it was a half-horse town. Why is it called a half-horse town? Because half the horse was out of the town. Right? That's how small the place was. So his father was a Rav in this place. His father is quoted in the Shach, meaning he knew his father was clearly a Talmud Chacham. The Shach had some other yichas as well. He himself was a young prodigy. At the age of around 12 or 13, it seems like he was sent off to Krakow. Krakow was a much larger community at the time. Of course, the Rama, who was the author of the Ashkenazi part of Shulchan Aruch, was the Rav in Krakow, but this is already 200 years later. But he was sent off to learn in Krakow by the Rebbe Rav Yeshua Heschel. If you go into the Krakow cemetery today, if you go to Krakow today in the Rama's shul, so as you, right behind the shul is where the Krakow cemetery is. And right in the front, right when you walk in, is the section of the Rabbanim. So right when you come in, you see a couple of Kvarim, in very prominently. One of them is the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles. And right next to him is Rav Yeshua Heschel, who was the Rebbe of the Shach for a couple of years. At some point, still being very young in his teenage years, he married the daughter of Rav Shimon Wolf. Rav Shimon Wolf himself had significant yichus in that he was the great-grandson of the Rama. So we're about 200 years later. Is this echo still? I'm hearing it again, but if nobody else is complaining, I'll ignore it. He grew up. So he married the daughter of Shimon Wolf, who seemed to be a wealthy person, great grandson of the Rama, and that brought him out to Vilna. So now, at the young age of his upper teens, he is now married. He moves to Vilna, and as still it seems, as an 18 or 19 year old, is welcome to be on the Beistin of Vilna. Now, it sounds for now, again, a very prestigious spot. It wasn't, you know, being in the Beistin of Vilna, but then again, Vilna wasn't a very large town, but it still probably was the largest town in the area. And the person who invited him on was probably the first person to write a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And that was the Chelkas Mechokek. The Chelkas Mechokek, you may not know, but he is the other side of the page on the Choshen Mishpat section of Shulchan Aruch. So on the law section of Shulchan Aruch dealing with monetary law, on the two sides of the page, one side is the Chelkas Mechokek, on the other side is the Shach, is the Sifsei Kohen. So they were, Chelkas Mechokek is much older than him, but the Shach joined him as a member of the Beis Din in Vilna, and interestingly enough, later on, they are both the two main commentaries on the section of Shulchan Aruch of Choshen Mishpat. Now, in his young age then, he began work, at the age of 18, he began work on the commentary on Shulchan Aruch, on Yoredeya, not on Choshen Mishpat, but on Yoredeya. So that's what we, in the Monday night Shulchan Aruch Shir, that's what we cover every week. That's the Shach, the Sifsei Kohen. Some pointed out that it really should be the Sak, right? Sifsei Kohen. But, all right, the Shach is how it's known at the age of 18. But as a young man, and keep in mind at that time, nobody had really written a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch yet that had gained worldwide fame. I mean, people may have commented on it, but in terms of writing a running commentary, nobody had done it. And in fact, writing one at all for anybody is a controversial step. Why? Because when the Shulchan Aruch itself was a controversial book, right? There was the Gemara, there was the commentaries on the Gemara. And that was the way people established halacha. The idea of codifying halacha, the Rambam had done it, but the Rambam wasn't in Europe. That was a controversial move. And the Shulchan Aruch was a controversial book for that reason. I think we've covered this aspects about this in the past. But when the Shulchan Aruch was written, there were competitors that wrote their own books that were going to be larger and were going to have more background and was going to have more of the give and take. As opposed to the Shulchan Aruch, which was straightforward halacha, 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 very dry halachos. Now, the Shulchan Aruch himself, Rav Yosef Karo, wrote that my intention is that the Shulchan Aruch should be learned with the Beis Yosef, and the Shulchan Aruch is a book that I wrote as a review book that is supposed to be reviewed once every 30 days, which, it's 10 volumes, our editions is 10 volumes, but the truth is, if you just take the Shulchan Aruch itself, it's not so crazy to write to read it over the course of 30 days. It's because there's so many comments. There's only about 10 lines of Shulchan Aruch on every page. So it's not like a crazy thing, but that is what the Shulchan Aruch wrote. It's really supposed to be a review book, but using the establishment of the Shulchan Aruch for those 150, 200 years or so after it had been written was a controversial thing. The way to establish it as a central halachic book was really when commentaries began to be written on it. So the Shach started that process by writing his commentary on Yerideya. Now, the only problem is, he's a young guy at the age of 18 that nobody ever heard of because he's in Vilna. Yes, he spent some time in Krakow, which was a central Jewish location, but he was making a name for himself. He wasn't really making a name for himself because he was out in the middle of nowhere. So in order for him to become prominent, he traveled through Central and Eastern Europe collecting A, smichas, and B, haskamos, right? He had to first, someone to test him and see that he is fit to be called rabbi. And B, to also get haskamos, right? If you look in the beginning of most svarim, so especially ones written today, so there's letters that are written by more prominent rabbis certifying the fact that we've read this book, or we've read at least part of it, or I read a line or two, or I had a conversation with the author, and he seems like a good enough guy, so I'm hereby writing a letter on his behalf, and you could all write the book, or read the book and be able to gain from it. So young Shabtai Cohen travels through Europe collecting these haskamos, and one of the people that he collected from is the Taz, right? So the Taz becomes Rav David Halevi. The Taz was 40 years his senior, right? So if you look on the regular page of the Shulchan Aruch Yerideya, right, where we are normally learning on Monday nights, so you have the Shulchan Aruch in the middle, on one side you have the Shach, on the inside you have the Taz, and that's what's there. Now, what was their interaction with one another? So there's a couple of versions of how this meeting went. So there is a tradition. It's quoted in the Sefer Nefesh HaRav, which is Rav Shechter's recollections from the Rav. And the Rav quoted a tradition that he had from his grandfather, that when the Shach met the Taz realized that the Shach is trying to get a haskama for a book that he himself had also just published. The Taz was published, it seems like, I'm not exactly sure, but it seems like the Taz was published within a year of when he met the Shach. And the Taz looked at his book, and this is the way the story goes, the Taz realized that the Shach had written a better book. And for that reason, the Taz refused to give him the smicha and to give him the letter. That's the way the story goes. And for that reason, the Rav Soloveitchik supposedly said never taught the Taz. When he gave Shirim on Yerideya, at least in the earlier years, you can ask Rabbi Cohn if he recalls this, but he only quoted the Shach he didn't quote the Taz for that reason. And maybe that's the tradition why we pass like the Shach against the Taz. The other reason, the other traditional reason as to why we pass like the Shach and not the Taz is that there was an interaction, not that they met, but there was an interaction. Maybe we'll give a shiur on the Taz one day and talk about this. But the Taz actually perhaps had some acceptance, a small acceptance of Shabtai Tzvi. That there was some connection. The Shabtai Tzvi wrote him a letter, and it could be the Taz appreciated the fact that he got a letter, and maybe for that reason we paskin like the Shach over the Taz, but that generally is our tradition anyways. We paskin like the Shach over the Taz when we learn Yerideya. So in our Shir Monday night, we'll quote a Taz once in a while. We generally focus on the Shach rather than on the Taz. The Shach is an encyclopedia of sources. It's pretty phenomenal in those days, the people that he can quote. There sometimes he'll just rattle off Rishonim, you know, and it's not only is he rattling off Rishonim, but he's often rattling off his version of the Rishonim, meaning he might have a different view, right? He'll say, you know, I disagree with the Shulchan Aruch because the Shulchan Aruch probably didn't see this, you know, he might have seen source 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, but he didn't see 6, 7, 8, and 9, and his interpretation of 1, 2, and 3 are wrong anyways, right? So, therefore, you should be able to paskin like me over him. That's often what one might come across while reading a Shach. How did the Shach have access to all of these Sfarim? It's a pretty incredible thing. In the days way before computers, where did he have access? So the Chida is Rav Chaim David Azulai, who officially lived in Israel but traveled the world as a Meshulach on behalf of Israel, of the people living in Israel. This is already in the 1800s, but he would like leave for months and years at a time, and there's stories of how he arrived in different cities and stuff. In fact, if you go to Har Menuchos, right, by Har Nof, right, that cemetery that you, when you're driving from Tel Aviv into Yerushalayim, so on your right side, there is a large cemetery on a hill. So when you go to Har Menuchos, the first thing you see... What?
It's near Givat Shaul.
Right, the Givat Shaul Har Nof. So when you go there, the first thing you see, and it's not really shaped with the rest of... It's not like in the same dimensions as the rest of the cemetery, is an ohel, which is the burial site of the Chida. I don't know why he's buried there. It's way before Har Menuchos was there. But anyways, that's where the Chida is buried. So the Chida wrote a book, Doros HaRishonim, where he describes, it's like sort of a small biography of all the Gedolim from before him, from the previous 1500 years. So what he writes about the Shach is, how did the Shach get all of these sources? So the Chida said, because he had a malach, right? There was an angel who showed him all of these, sources, helped him out, and that's how he was able to have what he needed for the to write his commentary. The other possibility is that Vilna also had a very large university with a very large library, and it's very possible that's where the Shach was able to get a hold of all of these manuscripts. In fact, the Shach compares manuscripts. He compares, Shach, perhaps more than other people at his time, will say that something is a mistake because he's able to find other sources and stuff. And perhaps that's because the Shach was able to, do a lot of work in the library up in Vilna. There is the Shach in his commentary on Yerideya. Besides writing the Shach, also wrote a commentary called the Nekudas HaKesef. The Nekudas HaKesef is often, usually, it's attacks on the Taz, right? So he wrote the Shach at the same time that the Taz was writing the Taz, and then he wrote a sefer later on called the Nekudas HaKesef, which is on the side, right? Turi Zahav, the pillar of gold, and Nekudas HaKesef is the point of silver, meaning eye of points. In fact, the first page of a regular edition of Yerideya, right? On this side here is the Taz's introduction. This side here is the Shach's introduction. And on the bottom is the Nekudas HaKesef attacking something that the Shach said, that the Taz writes in his introduction, right? So he already is picking on him in the Hakdama itself. But on the second page over here, there is an introduction that he wrote to the Nekudas HaKesef. And in that introduction, he says that I actually met the Taz. The Taz came and stayed in my house, and he stayed here for 3 days, and we had a wonderful time talking to each other, and when he left, he gave me a kiss and said, you know, I should be matzliach, etc., which perhaps goes against that other story that they perhaps that they might have been at odds. So anyways, I remember somebody, what's his name, Yehuda Halpert, once gave a shiur in the Young Israel of Hillcrest, where he quoted that introduction to the Nekudas HaKesef and said, but I have a question, if the Taz was saying by the Shach, there are some things that the Taz is machmer on in terms of kashrus that the Shach is mekel on. So how could the Taz eat in the Shach's house? That was his, that was the premise he gave to for that shiur. But anyways, they maybe ate on paper plates. I don't know. He was able to get around it. Anyways, that is his the Shach's introduction. I believe though the Nekudas HaKesef wasn't published until after the Shach himself passed away. I believe. But anyways. And there is also a back and forth. There is actually a sefer. There's something that the Taz wrote to with his notes on the Shach, and there's something else that the Shach wrote against what the Taz wrote. There's one is called the I forgot which one is which. But anyways, so they go back and forth. They are pairs. Again, the Taz was 40 years older than the Shach and outlived the Shach by 5 years. Right. So the Taz lived much much longer than the Shach did. One story about the Shach is that when he was, there's a legend out there that there's two, I guess, legends of the Shach that we'll quote. I'm not sure how one could verify their truth, but that the Shach entered into a din Torah with somebody, that he had a fight with somebody else in some monetary issue, and he thought he was right. So they agreed to go to another Rav for a din Torah. So, but the guy said, against Shach, he says, but it's not fair because you're going to walk in the door and the judge is going to listen to all of your arguments. He's not going to, like the Shach is coming to me for a din Torah, right? It's already going to be biased. How is it going to be a fair din Torah? So the Shach said, okay, I won't tell him who I am, right? Well, I'll use an alias. So they went, they traveled to this town together and they had the din Torah. And the Shach reviewed, he went through his notes on Choshen Mishpat, monetary law, and he was sure that he was right. And the Rav paskin like the other guy, right? The Beis Din paskin like the one against the Shach. So the Shach said, okay, like, I guess I'll accept it, but like, I'm just wondering what your reasoning was. So he says, well, I said this and not that. So the Shach said, really? This and not that? So the person said, well, come with me, I want to show you something. And he takes him into his library, and he pulls off a brand new edition of the Shach off of his bookshelf, and he shows something. Look, I don't know who this, I got this sefer in the mail a couple of months ago, and it happens to be that he talks about this case, and he seems like he should paskin like the other guy instead of him. At which point the Shach revealed who he was and said, I realize that any time you're personally involved in a monetary case, you could be skewed, and you're right. Right, you're right. That which demonstrates, I guess, the honesty of the Shach, and also just importantly, anybody who's involved in monetary law or their own monetary cases should always make sure to get another opinion and before one assumes that you are absolutely right. The Shach himself, at least according to this story, made a mistake because of his biased view. Okay, so all of this is good stories, but it doesn't necessarily qualify for a pre-Tisha B'Av shir. So the Shach's life was pretty, again, he was born in 1622. In 1645 is when he went to Krakow in order to publish the Shach. And then you get to 1648, and that's when the whole world changed. What happened in 1648? So 1648 is known as the Gezeros Tach V'Tat. 57 08 and 57 9, right? Those are those are the years of this. What was it? Also known as the Chmielnytskyi massacres. So how did oh, nice note from Sam. Is that public information? An email just flashed across my screen where Sam said that the Shach is his eighth generation grandfather. So okay, you could check with the mishpacha in case I make any other mistakes. So through in my Googling for this year, I came across a family tree from the Shach. I don't know. I'll send you the link to it. What?
I didn't hear what you just said.
Online, I came across somebody who put out like a full family tree that included the Shach in it.
Okay.
So I'll send it along. So the so what were the Chmielnytskyi massacres? So Ukraine, sorry, the Polish, again, there's Poland and the Ukraine, right? And as there are different countries today, and perhaps there are different people, the Ukrainians are a different religion even, right? The Ukrainians, I think, are Greek Orthodox, while the Polish are Roman Catholic, at least at that time. And the plains of Ukraine is what defends, I guess, Europe from, you know, from Mongolia and China and Muslim lands and things like that. So the Polish were interested in perhaps setting up alliances, first setting up alliances with the people of Ukraine. And then they started like kind of taking over the land, right? They sort of like started establishing castles or establishing dominions there and claiming the people that were living there became known as the Cossacks as their serfs or as people that would work for them or as sharecroppers or things of that nature. So this like got them annoyed. This is happening already in the 15th century. And this is going on for a century and a half or so. And every 10, 15 years, there was like some kind of uprising or rebellion. It was put down and people continued to live. Now this, in 1648, this fellow named Chmielnytskyi, I wrote down his first name here someplace. Bogdan Chmielnytskyi was able to gather an army around him and also be able to enlist the help of some Mongols, some people further to the east. And they were actually able to raise a fight and start attacking into Europe. Now, beyond their attacks into Europe, there were specific attacks against the Jews, because apparently Jews were used as the tax collectors. Right? That was one of the jobs that the Polish royalty enlisted Jews for, was to actually go into Ukraine and start harassing these people in order for them to pay up their taxes and things like that. So the Jews were not liked by these people, and therefore they were chosen for attack when Chmielnytskyi came with his band in. So that first, it's what's known as the first attack, is recorded as being in the town of Nemirov, which is in the middle of the Ukraine. And what happened was, is that they knew that things were tense at the time. The Jewish people were in Nemirov. It was a walled city. And the Cossacks came. But as they came, they unfurled, and I think this would be considered a war crime today, but they unfurled Polish flags saying that we're Polish people, and they sent word saying that we're here to protect you from the Cossacks who are going to be attacking soon. So they let them, so the people in the city actually were in on it anyways, let them in, and they came in, and these were the Cossacks actually, and came and killed something like 6,000 Jews on that day, which was Chaf Sivan 1848. Now keep in mind, 1648. Keep in mind that date, Chaf Sivan, for a couple of minutes. But that was the first attack, and then they continued attacking throughout Europe. Then it stopped because some of their help kind of said, all right, we've had enough, and they went home. But then they were able to join forces with others, I believe the Swedes or something, they came, and that's how they were able to attack in the north. This was going on for years. So this goes to started in 1848. The Shah had already left Krakow by then, it seems, ended up back in Poland, back in Vilna.
1848,
and this is now already 1855, so this is now 7 years later. And there was an attack on the city of Vilna. The Shah ran from Vilna to Lublin. He was there for 3 months until there were attacks on Lublin. He ran away from Lublin, ended up in Moravia, what's it, Czechoslovakia today, or Czech Republic today, I guess you would say, in a town called Halyshaw, where he lived a couple of more years. He died in 1663. So 8 years after that attack is when he passed away. I didn't see anything that it was. He was not an old man already, right? That's the age of 41 or 42. So he's not an old man. But I didn't see anywhere describing what was the cause of death. for him, whether it was a result of the massacres or not. So that is the Shach's life. Now there is a legend that is told, and this made it into novels. And I actually saw that this became in my searches around, like the Beis Yaakovs in the early years would do, did their annual plays, would act out this story as a play. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. Whether parts of it are true or not, I don't know. Maybe Sam knows, as it's maybe it's his mishmacha. But this is made it's unclear whether novels are based on a true story. There's like three or four editions of the story out there. Some of them it says based on the true story. Another one I saw, it said based on a novel written 100 years after the passing of the Shach. But the story goes is that we'll do it very quickly because it's pretty lengthy, that when the Shach was running away from Vilna, I guess got feedback again. When the Shach was running away from Vilna, he had a daughter with him. His daughter's name was Esther. That name, now that is true. The Shach did have a daughter named Esther. Beyond that, I don't know. Beyond that, I'm not sure what else is true. But the Shach, he went to hide in the forest, and his daughter was very sick already. And he realized that she had stopped breathing. And then he heard the soldiers come. So he quickly ran away. He hid someplace. And when the soldiers passed, he went back to find his daughter, who he thought had already even had died. And the daughter wasn't there anymore. So the Shach felt like he has no idea what happened. He has no idea what happened to her. He said, not only did my daughter die as a result of this, but now I don't even have an opportunity to give her a Kever Yisrael. And tested his, whatever. That obviously would be a tragedy for the Shach. The Shach then moves on, again, as we said, to Lublin and then to Czechoslovakia. Now this daughter then grows up in, so what actually happened was, is that a king had come by, saw this girl laying there and said, Nebuch, this girl should just die there. Let me take her into let me take her and care for her. And he brought her into the palace, and she grew up in the palace and became friends with the daughter, with the king's princess, the king's daughter. At one point, saved the daughter's life. That's a story that's out there. He saved the daughter's life. But she realized she was Jewish, and at some point they tried convincing her to become Christian, and instead she escaped. She used the fire as an opportunity to escape. The king's family thought she had died. She ended up in, I think, Vilna again. I'm not sure. I got to check the story. She ended up in the town again, where she was helped out, eventually married somebody who helped her. And then at some point later on, when this princess, who was her friend growing up, became the princess of this area where she was living, they wanted to impose significant taxes on the community, and this girl, Esther, the daughter of the Shach, went and said hi to her old friend growing up and convinced them not to put on these large taxes on the community, right? So anyways, you can see the connection of Esther, right? Esther being growing up in the palace of whatever, but that's a story that's out there about the Shach's daughter. Don't know how whether any of it is true or which parts of it are true. Again, beyond the fact that the Shach had a daughter named Esther. Okay, but the other aspect of the Shach is that the Shach wrote a recording of and I'm not sure how he got this, but he actually has a recording of the travels of Chmielnitsky during this time, and he lists off, and there is a book called the Megillas Eifa, where it goes through the various places that they went and the atrocities that were done. It's available on Otzer HaChachma, and I was able to track down, I copied part of it last week when I was started preparing it, and then today I got locked out of my Yeshiva University account. I emailed them, they said you're back on, but it takes 24 hours for the system to reset itself. So I only was able to print out the end of the pages, the last section of this, which I printed out already last week. But the entire book, it's over 100 pages, where he goes through, again, the stories, and he lists off Rabbanim that died al Kiddush Hashem during this time. And then towards the end, he says, Al Kain Kavati la'atzmi uldorosai levanim ulvnevanim yom tzom v'tanis ve'evil umispeid v'kinim. And based on this destruction, by the way, I forgot to give the number, it was understood, although I think modern scholars, I looked on Wikipedia at least, doubts the number a little bit. But in the Jewish tradition, we understand that someplace around 500,000 Jews were killed over the course of the Chmielnytsky uprising. The way J.G. Schachter told us before the Holocaust, people used to refer to Chmielnytsky the way we refer to Hitler. Right? They don't just say it was Chmielnytsky Yimach Shemo, or Yimach Shemo v'Zichro. Right? He was that type of figure for the Jewish people for several centuries until you get to the middle of the 20th century. So the Shach writes, therefore I'm going to establish for myself and for all generations and my children a fast day that we're going to sit and mourn, Biyom Chaf L'Chodesh Sivan, on the 20th day of Sivan. Remember, that's the date that we mentioned before. Why the 20th day of Sivan? Meaning this is something that went on for a year and a half and then went on for a couple of years afterwards. So how are you going to pick one day to be the day that's going to be the fast day, the day of remembrance of these occurrences? So he says, well, in Sivan is when the Torah was given. V'yata karua parua goyim rabim hamonim hamonim. Right? And now it was torn up, meaning the Torah was damaged during this time. Okay, that's why it's in the month of Sivan. And he says also, reason number again, yon ki yom zeh hu techilas legezerus u'machabos v'chaloyim roimenem manim. Right? And this was the beginning of the bad times. Right? This is when that attack on Nemirov took place. So therefore it's appropriate that it be on Chav Sivan. Then he gives two other reasons that are even more interesting. The next reason he says is gam ki gam gezeiras v'gam ki bo huchbelo hatsaros v'kilkulim mekilkulim shonim. Right? And also, that is also a day that we've had other terrible things that have taken place on Chav Sivan. What is that? So he says ki gam gezeiras Tuf Tuf Kuf Lamed Aleph. What is Tuf Tuf Kuf Lamed Aleph? So that's the year 4931, which corresponds to 1171. What happened on that day? Haysab biyomahu uva osan hazmanim. Of what happened then? What happened then? So that was actually the date of the killing for the first blood libel that took place in Europe, on continental Europe. That in 1171 there was somebody who was seen in southern France in the city of Blois, Blois, Blois on the Seine River. Somebody, I think you could go there today. There was somebody who was seen doing something by the river by a non-Jew. He was reported to the priest. He said he must be disposing of a Christian body for the use of matzos. Right, this rumor already had started back then. And then they had a trial, etc. And then by Chaf Sivan, either 31 or 33, it's unclear, Jews were killed in the city of Blois in the year 1171 on Chaf Sivan. Word got out, and the person living there, someone named Rav Ephraim of Bun, wrote about this.
Can you write the name of the city for me?
B L O I S.
B-L-O-I-S.
I put it in the chat.
Blo, okay.
Yeah, you've been there?
Blo. Okay. No, I think it's a suburb of Paris, but it's interesting. I'm going to check online.
South of Paris. So, I just got the... you muted. Okay, so he... So during that time... So someone named Rav Ephraim of Bun, who was a Rishon living at that time, writes that they're established a fast, we decided to establish a fast day because of these 31 or 33 Jews that were killed, and got passed around that on the 20th day of Sivan we would have this fast day. And Rabbeinu Tam agreed. Rabbeinu Tam was the Gadol Hador at that time. He wasn't living there, but he was far away. But Rabbeinu Tam agreed that we should have a fast day on Chav Sivan. And therefore, that was established, and you see, this is already 500 years later, almost, right? The Shach was either kept the fast day, or at least knew about this fast day that was taking place on Chav Sivan, and said, aha, for that reason, it's appropriate that the fast day that we establish for the Chmielnytsky massacres should be on the same day, right? On the day of Chav Sivan. Now, this has a lot of significance with regards to the machlokas about having a separate day of Yom HaShoah, right? Having Yom HaShoah is a controversial thing. In the Haredi world, it's not really observed. In the more modern Orthodox world, in the Tzioni world, it is observed, right? But this is a big part of that discussion, because the approach of the Gedolim right after the war, right? There's a story that Rav Herzog went to the Brisker Rav and told the Brisker Rav we should really have a fast day to recall for those who died during the time of the Holocaust. And the Brisker Rav responded by saying that it says in the Kinos, the one that's described about the Crusades, that they thought about having a separate day of remembrance for the Crusades, but we can't because it's prohibited to add additional days. Rather, everything's going to be based around Tisha B'Av, right? So that's one side saying that you can't add extra days. But this idea that the Shach clearly established a day based on a day that perhaps was established by Rabbeinu Tam, that Chaf Sivan should be a fast day. And there are, if you look around in older Siddurim, you might even see hints to the idea that there is such a thing as an observance of Chaf Sivan. I don't know of anybody that observes it today, but at least that was an established idea. So that's reason number two. And then actually reason number three, the Shach says, and this is like brilliance, says, Vegam, by the way, the third reason, Ki Yom Zeh Lo Yeireh B'Shabbos Kodesh B'Shum Panim. Says, by the way, Chaf Zivan never falls out on Shabbos, right? Like, who even thinks about that? And who even figures that out, right? But anyways, the Shach said, and by the way, you'll never have a problem with it falling out on Shabbos, because it never falls out that way. So that's the Shach's significance. He was the recorder of perhaps what would be considered the greatest massacre of the Jewish people, at least from the time of the Beis HaMikdash until the time of the Holocaust. And he, in a way, records it, and he keeps track of it, and established a day for its remembrance. Suffered from it, and then established a day for its remembrance. So the Shach's life was turned upside down, right? He did write other things. The Shach wrote, by the way, his Sefer on Chosha Mishra was printed much later in his life. There are quotations of things that the Shach wrote on all four sections of Shulchan Aruch, which we don't have. We only have what he wrote on Yoredei and Choshen Mishpat. All right, there's other things that we have that he wrote as well. But whether his life was cut short or not due to this is unclear, but certainly his life was interrupted due to this issue. There were, by the way, significant Torah changes, and perhaps, right, during this time, right, the Shulchan Aruch we mentioned before became official partly because the Shach wrote a commentary on it, and the Taz wrote a commentary on it. Right, once there are commentaries being written on it, that established it as being a central book. And the other thing that I saw that is interesting is that any time that there is a huge upheaval of the Jewish people, so that upsets the Mesorah, that upsets the tradition. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Soloveitchik, his perhaps most famous article is on this topic called Rupture and Reconstruction, where he talks about how after the Holocaust, everybody's turned to books. I mean, people lost their mimetic tradition. People lost their tradition of father, people just following the minhagim of their father, and start learning everything from Sfarim. Which he says, that's why all of a sudden you see in this time, Shmir Shavs Kehilchasa, Brachuska, all of these halachic books didn't really exist until post-Holocaust, and he suggests that that's the reason. So perhaps going back to the time of the Shach as well, what changed, right, what made the Shulchan Aruch a central book is that with so much upheaval in the community, people no longer had the traditions from their Rabbanim and from the towns that they lived in, and now kind of had to look to a book. And what book was available? So the book that was available was the Shulchan Aruch with new commentaries that were recently being published by Rosh Hapsaya Cohen, by the Taz, by Magin Avram, the Chilkas Mechokek, the one on Evan Ezra, as well as the other commentaries that we find on the bottom. So that's some of the story of the Shach. There's much more to the story, but hopefully we'll use that as inspiration for growth as we head into Tisha B'Av. Okay, we'll stop here. Good to see everybody. I guess we'll see you, Mirsa Hashem, on Wednesday. Okay.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, night.
Oh, very good.